In Washington, the sense that the United States was just dodging al-Qaeda bullets rekindled the desire for a military plan to end the bin Laden problem. At the end of one meeting in the cabinet room, Clinton approached Joint Chiefs Chairman Hugh Shelton and said, "You know, it would scare the shit out of al-Qaeda if suddenly a bunch of black ninjas rappelled out of helicopters into the middle of their camp. It would get us enormous deterrence and show those guys we're not afraid." Shelton, a huge, powerfully built man, blanched. The NSC followed up with a request for a new military plan, a small package that did not require using the entire 101st Airborne Division. Some weeks later, Secretary of Defense Cohen and Shelton's deputy, Air Force General Richard Myers, came to the White House and briefed Berger and his deputy, General Don Kerrick. The military wanted to help. Cohen and Myers shared Clinton's eagerness to act, and, as always, the armed forces would do what they were told. But the answer to the request for a small operation was, it would be Desert One, the 1980 attempt to liberate American hostages in Tehran, which resulted in the incineration of two helicopters and the deaths of eight servicemen. For the most part, military doctrine called for special operations forces to be used in support of other units. Finding Scud missile launchers behind Iraqi lines in the Gulf War was a good example of this kind of mission. The doctrine was supported by the strong inclination, enduringly reinforced by Desert One, of military planners and commanders. Many are reluctant to use special forces, viewing the risky operations they take on as prone to disaster, embarrassment, and casualties. After Desert One, the U.S. military began work to improve its special forces capacities. In the 1990s, as military theorists increasingly considered the coming age of asymmetric warfare, large sums of money were poured into the Special Operations Command, or SOCOM. Such units as Delta Force and the Navy SEALs developed into highly skilled, unconventional fighting forces, trained for a variety of terrorism-related contingencies. But the chiefs and their minions remained extremely cautious about using them. Their reluctance to use the operators in Bosnia to capture war criminals, for instance, had irritated policymakers. This stance would remain largely unchanged until the war in Afghanistan in 2001. The White House had little recourse. It would not work to order the military to undertake a mission believed to be suicidal. Tom Pickering recalled worrying that someone was going to put out the story that the NSC and state wanted to hazard the lives of young Americans in a wild goose chase. The Pentagon has a great capacity to let things leak to keep from doing them. Were the chiefs ducking a mission for which they had no enthusiasm? Military establishments are almost by definition conservative. General Tommy Franks's first plans for attacking Afghanistan, presented in September 2001, called for five or six divisions to be deployed in an old-style invasion, exactly what the Bush administration did not want. Without a landscape-changing event, they were unlikely to drastically revise their special forces doctrine. But they were also, according to one former senior political appointee at the Pentagon, particularly unwilling to go out on a limb for Clinton. Much time had passed since his disastrous first year in office, and the watershed events of 1993-94, the decision to end discrimination against gays in the military, the killing of the Army Rangers in Somalia, and the hasty withdrawal of U.S. forces from that country, had not so much receded into memory as been woven into a perpetually troubled relationship between the White House and the military. As this former official put it, Shelton, like Powell, had eyed up Clinton and decided he didn't have the guts to fight a war. And if you make that conclusion, you're not going to put forward anything in a gray area because you're afraid he's going to wimp out. I think the Pentagon became more nervous and timid because they thought Clinton was, and so they would not put forward risky plans in a serious way. By the end, they just didn't believe. They were so used to pulling their punches, they had written him off, taking strong action. The rotation of submarines in the Arabian Sea continued, the vessels hovering in the basket awaiting intelligence. Once more in 2000, A report arrived detailing bin Laden's whereabouts for a brief window of time. On a Sunday afternoon, while the second thread of intelligence was being pursued, the missiles were spun. George Tenet, who was attending his son's soccer game, called Berger and told him, "We don't have it."